I've been reading from chapter 10 of First Canto. Chapter 10 is Departure of Lord Krishna for Dwarka. The last verse that I read from was in St. Louis on prayers that the ladies of Hastinapur were reciting in glorification of Krishna, as Krishna was leaving Hastinapur. And I'm going to skip ahead and read texts 31 through 36, which closes the chapter. To appreciate the scene, Krishna was stopped from leaving three times already, Uttara, Kunti, and Yudhisthira. And that goes to the end of chapter 8. Chapter 9, they go to the scene where Grandfather Bhishma is lying on the bed of arrows, and Bhishma Dev pacifies Yudhisthira. Because one of the reasons for Krishna's remaining in Hastinapur at the request of Yudhisthira were two reasons that are mentioned. One was to pacify the begrieving Yudhisthira, and the other was to pacify his sister, Krishna. Krishna's sister was? Who was Krishna's sister?
Subhadra.
So, she had lost her only son, and had a son, a grandson, in the form of Maharaj Parikshit, who was yet to be born. So to pacify Subhadra and Yudhisthira, Krishna remained. But even he's the personality of Godhead, he was unable to pacify Yudhisthira, but Bhishma was able to pacify, by Krishna's arrangement for that to happen that way. And then Bhishma Dev instructed Maharaj Yudhisthira how he should perform his duties, and the chapter ends. Grandfather Bhishma leaves. So Yudhisthira, the beginning of chapter 10, is Yudhisthira is now the king and he's ruling, and the beginning verses are describing what a glorious situation it was when you have a ruler of the qualification of Maharaj Yudhisthira, and he's the king of the world. His piety set an example for everyone else to follow. So everyone was pious. And he was fully surrendered to the personality of Godhead, and so because of that full surrender, all necessities, all bounty, everything was supplied opulently. The opulence of the kingdom of Maharaj Yudhisthira rivaled the king of heaven. The demigods used to regularly come and visit. Pay a visit. Drive around the corner and go visit Maharaj Yudhisthira. Interplanetary travel was possible, but the demigods had reason to go, and now they don't have reason to go, because where is there such a king? Name him. Name the other names, and we don't want to go there. So there's a lot of cultural discussion about the merit of monarchy, what that type of government can do if properly directed, and if there isn't a qualified person to be monarch, then you're going to have an unqualified person by some other means, and the unqualified person isn't going to satisfy the people, and so they always want to pull the person down and put another person up and pull that person down. Turmoil, Kali Yuga. So Yudhisthira's kingdom is flourishing. Krishna is now ready to go back. His purpose for coming has been fulfilled. He he's going back to Dwaraka. And then this scene after scene of different persons and the feelings of separation that they have because of attachment for Krishna, they're feeling separation from Krishna as he's leaving. And the last group that's being discussed is he's actually left the palace and he's left the central part of the city and he's on the way out of the city, and on the rooftops the ladies who are wives of the residents of Dwaraka, in their shyness they're on the rooftops and they're seeing Krishna for the first time, and their hearts are thrilled with happiness as they're speaking about his glories, and they're not highly scholarly educated Sanskrit intellectuals, but their words were more pleasing to Krishna than the very beautifully composed hymns of the Vedas that were being sung by the Brahmanas. And so, beautiful prayers. Very philosophical, quite profound, where they're understanding Krishna's position and how it is that one can become fortunate enough to understand Krishna. The verse that we read in St. Louis in the morning just yesterday was, they said, here is the same Supreme Personality of Godhead whose transcendental form is experienced by the great devotees who are completely cleansed of material consciousness by dint of rigid devotional service and full control of life and the senses. And that is the only way to purify existence. So very nice verse. Seeing Krishna with proper regard requires qualification. Seeing Krishna in any case requires good fortune, but one can be highly fortunate and not understand Krishna at all. Shishupal didn't understand Krishna at all, and Kamsa, and so many persons saw Krishna and didn't understand Krishna at all. But those that were very fortunate to see Krishna with right understanding, these qualifications, rigid devotional service, full control of life, and full control of the senses. So they go on describing Krishna's position as the Personality of God at the source of everything. He describes his lila in Vrindavan, his lila in Dwaraka, the souls connected to Krishna, how fortunate they are, the queens of Krishna, how Krishna saved them from Bhomasura, and how many lifetimes of austerities and means of purification must they have undergone to have that good fortune, and so on. So they're, because that's where Krishna is going, is Dwaraka, that's where the prayers end. How fortunate are the residents of Dwaraka, because they're now going to have Krishna's association. So that ends their prayers. Text 31. While the ladies of the capital of Hastinapur were greeting him and talking in this way, the Lord, smiling, accepted their good greetings and, casting the grace of his glance over them, departed from the city. There's no purport here, but same thing happens in Krishna's next chapter. He's entering into Dwaraka, and they're up on the rooftops again. And Krishna just glanced. And as he glanced over them, they received Krishna's glance with their eyes, and that mercy that Krishna was giving went into their hearts. The description is that, and they felt as satisfied as if they had embraced Krishna, just by his glance. But Krishna's glance is not ordinary. Krishna's glance is not ordinary. With Krishna's glance, he can create universes, and with Krishna's glance, or Ramchandra's glance, he can boil an ocean. Or he can pierce the heart of the young damsels of Braja. Naranarayan, with his smile, he just created unlimited numbers of beautiful forms that bewildered the mind of Kandarpa or Cupid when he was sent by Indra to break his meditation. So Krishna glanced upon the ladies who were offering these wonderful prayers. By his smile and his glance, they were completely satisfied. Text 32. Maharaj Yudhisthira, although no one's enemy, engaged four divisions of defense, horse, elephant, chariot, and army, to accompany Lord Krishna, the enemy of the asuras, or demons. The Maharaj, that's Yudhisthira, did this because of the enemy and also out of affection for the Lord. So in a previous section it describes what a division of soldiers is. It's so many thousands of horses and so many thousands of elephants and so many thousands of chariots drawn by horses, so many infantry, foot soldiers. Four divisions to accompany Krishna. Krishna, who doesn't need such accompaniment, Krishna alone, standing in the battlefield with Jarasandha, completely destroyed many more divisions, alone, without any other soldier. So many times, 20-something, 22 times, something like that, just completely annihilated them. So he didn't require. But because Krishna didn't require doesn't mean Maharaj Yudhisthira thought, oh, Krishna doesn't require, so I don't have any service to do. He was rendering service just because he wanted to render some service. And that's, as the king, that was one service he could render. And the consideration was that although Yudhisthira Maharaj had no enemy, that's one part, but because of the enemy. So what's the enemy? The enemy is those who are envious of Krishna. They have a problem with Krishna. So where Krishna goes, they have enmity. Although he has not provoked enmity, he didn't even fight in the battle. You can have my soldiers or you can have me, whichever, but I'm not going to take part in the battle. Still, there were envious persons. So, because of the enemy and out of affection for the Lord. Now, this role is very interesting. Because in a previous verse in this chapter, when Krishna was getting ready to leave, the Pandavas, one of the groups of persons that came, were the Pandavas. And during the coronation ceremony of Maharaj Yudhisthira, Krishna carried the umbrella, the white royal umbrella, and was offering prayers and glorification of the new king, Maharaj Yudhisthira. Just like a servant. And when Krishna was leaving and the Pandavas came forward, Krishna placed his head at the feet of Maharaj Yudhisthira. Because Maharaj Yudhisthira was elder, and the king. And Krishna was the prince in Dwaraka. So he's the emperor. I offer my tribute to the emperor. Maharaj Yudhisthira knew very well Krishna is not just, you know, a prince over there in Dwarka somewhere, and I'm the emperor. He knew he's the personality of Godhead. And yet he allowed him to do that. Like, Arjuna allowed Krishna to be his chariot driver. It's like, you know, toss somebody the keys and say, can you drive me there? But it's, he understood Krishna's mood. He's the personality of Godhead, and he wants to do like this. So who am I to check Krishna from doing what he wants to do? So when Krishna rose, Maharaj Yudhisthira embraced him. And with the Bhima and Arjun, they both embraced like equals of age, the dearmost friend Arjun and Bhima. And Nakul and Sahadev, they came before Krishna and placed their heads at Krishna's feet. So, like this, Krishna engaged in exchanges according to social position or the etiquettes of cultured people. But here, the same person, Yudhisthira, who is receiving Krishna, bowing before him, is honoring Krishna by sending two Akshohini divisions of soldiers to protect he who doesn't need any defense. Just as a service in honor of Krishna. The Lord played the part of a subordinate in his transcendental sporting, and thus sometimes he puts himself in the care of Yashoda Mata for his protection in his so-called helplessness of childhood. While he was in the protection of Yashoda in his helplessness of childhood, it's like with the Trinavarta demon, the killing of Trinavarta, Mother Yashoda was holding Krishna. And Krishna knew that Trinavarta was coming. And he didn't want his mother to see, because it would be too horrible for her to see him being carried away by Trinavarta, which was the Leelas. So Krishna became heavy. Became so heavy, Mother Yashoda couldn't hold him anymore. So she put him down and went to do her duties. And when Krishna was lying on the ground and Trinavarta came, that's when he saw, now is my chance, and carried Krishna. And Krishna was enjoying the ride. But then at a certain point, again he became heavy. So heavy, so heavy, so heavy. So heavy that it was choking Trinavarta. A little boy. What was the age of Trinavarta? Was just a couple months old. And his hands, little, think of a child that's 2-3 months old and how small their hands are, around the throat of Trinavarta, and he couldn't breathe. He tried pulling. And Krishna was too strong. And he was getting heavier and heavier. Get off me! Let go! Like Putana. And finally he couldn't breathe. He became, whatever the word is, he couldn't breathe. He died. And then fell crashing to the ground. Hit a big stone slab and finished. All his body's bones in his body were smashed. So he's helpless in the lap of Mother Yashoda, but he's the omniscient Lord who has all mystic powers and is fully conscious of everything at every moment and can exhibit those transcendental opulences at will and withdraw them at will. So here he is, accompanied by the divisions of soldiers of Maharaj Yudhisthira, helping him make his way back to Dwarka safely. It's just part of Krishna's Leela. Out of profound affection for Lord Krishna, the Pandavas, who were of the Kuru dynasty, accompanied him a considerable distance to see him off. They were overwhelmed, snigdhan, full of affection for Krishna, and he's leaving. Overwhelmed with the thought of future separation. But one of the Lord's opulences is his detachment. So he persuaded them to return home. And then he proceeded toward Dwarka with his dear companions. No purport. Oh, Shonaka, Sutta speaking. The Lord then proceeded towards Kuru Jangala, Panchala, Shurasena, the land on the bank of the river Yamuna, Brahmarvarta, Kurukshetra, Matsya, Sarasvata, the province of the desert. There's a couple of deserts. And the land of scanty water, so Prabhupada is saying, Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh. After crossing these provinces, he gradually reached the Sovira and Abhira provinces. Then, west of these, reached Dwarka at last. So Prabhupada gives what the current names are. Delhi, Punjab, Rajasthan, Madhya Pradesh, Saurashtra, Gujarat, and at last reached his home in the province of Dwarka. Having said that, Prabhupada writes, but we do not gain any profit simply by researching the analogous provinces of those days up to now. But it appears that the desert of Rajasthan and the provinces of scanty water like Madhya Pradesh were present even 5,000 years ago. The theory of soil experts that the desert developed in recent years is not supported by the statements of the Bhagavatam. But we may leave the matters for expert geologists to research further. Because the changing universe has different phases of geological development. Dwarkadham. We are satisfied that the Lord has now reached his own province, Dwarkadham, from the Kuru provinces. Kurukshetra continues to exist since the Vedic age, and it is sheer foolishness when interpreters ignore or deny the existence of Kurukshetra. Now, I don't know which brilliant scholar, there must have been some contemporary scholar at Prabhupada's time that was saying that Kurukshetra is not a place, it's symbolic of something. It's one of the renderings of Bhagavad Gita. Because Prabhupada would regularly refer to it. There's a place in the railway station called Kurukshetra. You can go there. It's a physical place. Today you can go there. It's Kurukshetra. It's not something imagined by some philosopher poet. Physical place. Sacred place. Therefore, Dharmakshetra, Kurukshetra. Samavida Yuyutsavaha. Text 36, the last verse of the chapter. On his journey throughout these provinces, he was welcomed, worshipped, and given various presentations. In the evening, in all places, the Lord suspended his journey to perform evening rites. This was regularly observed after sunset. So, in the purport Prabhupada puts in italics, since the Lord is absolute, everything done by him is good for everyone. So when Krishna performs Leela, the message is, he's giving benefit. Whatever it is that he does, it's simply for benefiting others. Just like it's said that a saintly person, what is the hallmark of all saintly persons? They do wonderful service to others. In fact, our constitutional position is to be a servant. So what do? We serve. And those that are connected with that understanding of my identity is I'm a servant of Krishna. And as a servant of Krishna, I'm a servant of Krishna's, everything that is Krishna's. And that's everything. I'm a servant of everyone and everything, and ultimately servant of Krishna. And they don't deviate from that. Not sometimes I'm a servant and sometimes I'm something else. Always a servant. How does Krishna regard such a mood? He simply reciprocates with that mood. Whatever he does is for the benefit of others. There's nothing, he says in Bhagavad Gita, there's nothing he has to do. Because people have to do something when they want something. I'm lacking over here. So to get that thing that I'm lacking, I have to do something. So I have a duty to do. I have to get that something I want. But Krishna doesn't have anything that he's lacking in. So there's no duty. Nothing he has to do. But still he does. And why is he doing? He's doing out of kindness for living entities. And it's in another sense also, it's not being done by Krishna, it's being done by his energies. He doesn't have to lift the pinky. He doesn't even have to say something. He just wills something, and it is. There's nobody else you can say that about. Try to think of something that you can that happens just because you will it to happen, and it happens. There isn't something. But Krishna's like that. So here Krishna's observing religious principles. Why is he observing religious principles? Because he's setting an example. When the evening comes, you stop your day's activity, even in this case he's journeying back to Dwarka, and he calls it a day, and he does his evening religious rites. Not to counteract something or to get something. When Krishna descends on earth, he acts for the protection of the devotees and for the annihilation of the impious non-devotees. Although he has no obligatory duty, still he does everything so that others may follow. That is the way of factual teaching. One must act properly himself and teach the same to others. Otherwise, one will accept one's blind teaching. Krishna is himself the order of fruitive results. He is self-sufficient, and yet he acts according to the rulings of the revealed scriptures. In other words, so what to speak of ourselves? So when, conversely, when one sees, oh, Krishna's doing some duty, so he must be one like us. No. And, oh, Krishna is performing rasa dance, so we can too. Or something like that. The Lord in human society does what is the duty of everyone, but sometimes he does something extraordinary and not to be imitated. by the living being. His acts of evening prayer, as stated herein, must be followed by the living being. But it is not possible to follow his mountain lifting or dancing with the gopis. One cannot imitate the sun, which can exhaust water even from a filthy place. The most powerful can do something which is all good, but our imitation of such acts will put us in endless difficulty. Therefore, in all actions, the experienced guide, the spiritual master, who is the manifested mercy of the Lord, should always be consulted, and the path of progress will be assured. Very valuable. There's so many forces acting upon our lives in the course of modern living. And the lines of what's appropriate and inappropriate, what's to be done, what's not to be done, can get blurred. And so, and even our idea of what's religious. Appropriate is one thing, and even what's religious can get blurred. So we have the example of Krishna to help us get unblurred, and we have the guidance of, here in Prabhupada's language, the expert, the experienced guide, the spiritual master, who is the manifest mercy of the Lord, should always be consulted, and the path of progress will be assured. And as practicing devotees or aspiring sadhakas, we should be very, very careful, as much as is within our power, to always stay in a example setting course of behavior. Because even little things that we do, just as, you know, we've taken notice in the course of the lives of those around us, if there's a little, you know, shortcut, then everybody wants to take the shortcut. And the next thing you know, that's the standard. The shortcut is the standard. And then, okay, where's the next shortcut? And standards get lost very quickly. I can remember, just to give a for example, kitchen standards, nice example, or pujari room standards, or altar standards, you know, standards. When I was a new devotee, I was engaged in the pot room, and the pot room was next to the kitchen, and I was bhakta so-and-so, so I wasn't entitled to even go in the kitchen. I would put the pots by the door of the kitchen, and people, the initiated devotees and twice initiated devotees, would get the pots from outside the kitchen and bring them inside the kitchen. I didn't go in the kitchen. And then the rule was initiated devotees can be in the kitchen, but only a Brahmin can touch the flame. This just happened in Gita Nagari during one of our retreats. I was asked, it was Mother Kalini's birthday, her 62nd birthday. So they baked a big cake. So I had to be like, you know, Solomon and say, you know, what can be offered on the altar and what can't. So there was this, I could feel there's some tension about what's Maharaj going to say here, because, you know, like, what's the standard? So there were some persons that did some mixing, measuring, and then mixing, and then somebody else put the cake together, somebody else put the icing. So then, you know, it was the Brahmana that put the stuff in the oven, and the Brahmana that took the stuff out of the oven, and then somebody else put the icing on, and can that be offered to Radha Damodar? Well, I thought it was nice to have such a discussion, because there's at least concern about standards. So the rule that prevailed was the brahmanas touched the flame, which was the oven in this case, and others did some prep work prior to touching, because this is Radhakrishna deities, and that's the same at your home, but when you're, you know, when you're in the temple and there's Radhakrishna deities, then there's standards. I'll go a little bit further with this one. We invited Nrisimha Kavacha, who is the deity worship minister, deity minister for all of ISKCON, to come to North America and do an audit. Visit the temples that have Radhakrishna deities and see how are the standards being maintained. Oh. Bad. And one of the big failure marks all across, you know, the place is cleanliness. Cleanliness on the altar, cleanliness in the pujari room, cleanliness in the kitchen. And he took photographs and he showed it to the GBC at our meeting in Mayapur. You know, look at this is what the stove inside such and such temple looks like. Oh my God. And then stuff cooked on this stove or in baked in that oven are being offered to Krishna. And then, you know, it's not just in this place or that place, it's all around town and probably all around the world, and we're serving Krishna. So we need to have standards. So cutting corners. So Prabhupada made an exception. He said if you don't have, at a certain point, it was Brahmins only. If you have deities and you don't have Brahmins to touch the flame, then only initiated devotees. And other devotees can do prep work and only initiated devotees touch the flame. But it really should be, you should try to come to that standard. So once the standard goes down, it's really hard to bring it up again because people get used to, hey, what's, you know, look at the shortcut. And that's just one example. There's so many examples. Standards of Vaishnava etiquette and standards of how you chant the holy name and so many things. So we're not an organization of rules and regulations, we're an organization of Krishna consciousness. But Prabhupada and his strict followers showed by example so many things. And that the standards are there. Why we don't offer onions and garlic. And some people have a problem with that. You know, why? What's the deal? Onions and garlic. It's there's standards. And we offer that which is sattvic. Those things are not sattvic, so we don't offer them to Krishna. We only take that which is offered to Krishna, so we don't eat onions and garlic. 1, 2, 3. Done. But if you don't accept that Krishna is pure goodness, and we only offer things that are in the quality of goodness to Krishna, and we only take that which is offered to Krishna, therefore certain things are forbidden, then, you know, why have standards? And we're vegetarian. What's wrong with onion and garlic? And so many things. So many things. So there's, we're fortunate in that the knowledge of Srimad Bhagavatam is being presented in such a clear way, and Prabhupada didn't compromise. He didn't give us, you know, close but not quite. He gave us the real thing. We're very fortunate. And what's the purpose of all those? This is another even greater important item. What's the purpose of standards? The purpose of standards is not just so that you follow the standards. What's the following something that is to be done without understanding the purpose behind it, according to Rupa Goswami, is an impediment on the path of devotion as much as not following. Following without understanding the purpose and not following, there are both impediments. What's the purpose? The purpose is to please Krishna, to awaken our desire to please Krishna. So if we don't even understand who Krishna is or that it's important to please Krishna, we can follow something that helps us become qualified to understand how important it is to please Krishna. When we want to offer something to Krishna, it should be pure. What's the standard of purity? So scripture is there and our acharyas are there to show us by example what's the standard of purity. And although we're not qualified, we follow things to help us become qualified, become eligible to at least have some understanding of what purity is and some modicum of purity so that we can come before Krishna and make offerings to him that he will accept. Here's another one that just came to mind. This is something that I recently heard from Ramabhadra. Those of you that know Ramabhadra know he's strict. So he was sharing with me how he instructs one of our pujaris who's prone to be late, Anubhava, prone to be late. So when he, you know, gets to the point where Anubhava is becoming late again, he confronts him. And you don't want to be confronted by Ramabhadra. Right? I'm looking at Premananda. She's had some interactions with Ramabhadra where he can be very strong. So he says to Anubhava, Radharani hasn't accepted your offering. You made the offering 5 minutes late. Radharani hasn't accepted it. Prabhupada said, if you're not late, Radharani has no obligation to accept. Even it's, sattvic. No onions and garlic. But it was late. So that's the temple standard. And the standard of excellence or the standard of deity worship is these two main things, sometimes three, punctuality and cleanliness. So in your homes it's with regularity. What you do, you should do regularly. And very clean. And what's the standard of very clean for one person may be dirty for another person. It should be really clean, really like Krishna clean. I was invited to go into, at our GBC meeting, to go into a little side meeting with one of the persons who was previously Prabhupada's servant. Our secretary. And he stopped us at the door and said, no water, no food. It was like, sergeant of arms or something. He said, but I can't help it. This is how Prabhupada trained us. That you don't work in the same place that you eat. When you eat, you have to be very clean because, we don't have a sense of cleanliness. Prabhupada was very strict. Very strict. So I've had that training. What can I do? No food, no water. Leave your shoes outside. Hari Sori shared that Prabhupada had a practice that had happened with him, and he watched it happen again and again. When he had new persons who he was training, when they would make a mistake, Prabhupada would be very forgiving, and he would explain what the mistake was, what the right thing was, and ask if they've understood. And then they would say, of course, yes, Srila Prabhupada. And then the next time, the second time it happened, Prabhupada became very angry, very like, And then when it happened the third time, Prabhupada's lips would tremble. It's like, you didn't want to see that. You didn't want to make the same mistake the second time, certainly not the third time. And in this matter of cleanliness, Hari Sori said, if for him it came to the fourth time, and Prabhupada said, oh, you Western people, you're useless. Just have you understand what is cleanliness? It's impossible. It's like cleaning coal. But what Prabhupada's standard of cleanliness was wasn't clean phobia or something. Or germ phobia. It was standard of cleanliness. And seeing everything as the property of Krishna. Just a couple more Prabhupada stories. I heard this as a new devotee, that the devotees were going for a walk in a suburban place. It was a place where one of the homes they went by, there was some water running. So Prabhupada stopped, went over into the lawn and turned the water off. Went back onto the sidewalk and kept walking. And made comment, you know, wasting Krishna's energy. He couldn't, like, just walk by and let them waste Krishna's energy. He turned off the water. It wasn't like, you know, it was a sprinkler thing. It was just wasting water. Because it's Krishna's energy. So he would teach us by example. I remember hearing that the first time a radunga arrived, because when Prabhupada came, there were no radungas. He brought a pair of kartals, and the only drums that they had was, you know, the drums of the counterculture, a bongo drum. So that's what everybody played, or sometimes just like a, you know, one-ended drum. And then one devotee went to India and brought back a radunga. This was in Los Angeles. I was in Boston at the time. We heard the whole story. The devotee came in. He was so happy, and they showed Prabhupada the radunga. He immediately paid his obeisances, took off his upper garment, and wrapped the radunga and placed it on a pillow or a cushion, and said, "This is Balaram." He wanted to teach us by example, because the paraphernalia that is used in the worship of Krishna is an expansion of Balaram. Tadiya is expansion of Balaram. Or like the arti paraphernalia is worshipable because it's used in Krishna service. It's an expansion of Krishna's energy. So in so many ways, how do we behave? We require a good example. And take it another notch and say, how do we help people understand what is a devotee? It's by our behavior. And it's by the qualities that we carry. Not so much what we speak. What we speak is important, but what's our behavior? How do we conduct ourselves in different situations, challenging situations and new situations and so on? But there are many cultural points in the Bhagavatam, just like this little section of Krishna's leaving, and what was the nature of the exchanges. They were very appropriate for the particular persons in their social position. A little report from the college campuses of today. It's a buzz, at least in some places, it's a buzz. Social change. So, I I've suggested to some of our college preachers, ride the wave, get social change wave, and then, you know, connect those people that want to see social change and connect that inspiration for social change to go, not just, you know, they, you know, re-engineer the whole social structure, but get, you know, go back to basics, like, who are we? And how do you connect with who are we? And then you can get some different behaviors. Let's see what happens with that one. It's certainly a nice wave to ride. Because all of these concerns, they have spiritual solutions. And without the spiritual solution, bring about a social change, and is it going to be any better? Like Prabhupada comments about monarchy mentioned earlier. So monarchy went down because the kings became decadent and abusive. They were unqualified. So they had this power, kingly power, but they didn't have the qualification to use that power, and so the people they didn't like that kingly structure. Let's get another structure. So the other structure was elect somebody. But there's still nobody qualified. And the persons that are doing electing, they're less qualified. So a bunch of unqualified people get together and elect a big unqualified person. Like Hito Pradesh, you know, the jackals want a jackal. The dogs want a dog, and the birds want a bird. And where's the qualified person? Where's the qualified persons to select a qualified person? The system is defective. And so the lack is the qualified leader. So what's important is to create qualified leaders. How are you going to create qualified leaders if there isn't a qualified teacher? To create qualified leaders. So we need some qualified teachers. Devotees have to teach. So we have to learn, and then by example teach. So the learning method is the Srimad Bhagavatam. Vyasadeva recognized the problem, and so he composed the Srimad Bhagavatam as the solution under Narada's direction. And just to repeat the last sentence that we read, and I'll end. Therefore, in all actions, the expert guide, the spiritual master who is the manifest mercy of the Lord, should always be consulted, and the path of progress will be assured. Oh, any comments or discussion? Yes.
Guru Maharaj, and you were explaining about the standards in the kitchen and mentioned onions and garlic that we all know and we follow. And the reason, because of being Rajagun foods, you know. In the description of the Bhagavad Gita, you also is described not only the pungent and, you know, that type of Rajagun, but also very hot and salty and that type of
thing. Yes.
Not necessarily put so much emphasis in the very hot, you know, in an ISKCON, which I don't mind, but, you know, but I'm curious. I often, you know, have this curiosity that one passed through, but, you know.
Our standard, the gauge that we go by is our founder Acharya. So, fortunately, we still have persons who are directly trained by Srila Prabhupada. And it's, you know, very important for them, like Mother Jamuna's cookbook. I mean, you follow Mother Jamuna's cookbook, and you can put something that makes something a little spicy or a little hot, but it's not in the category of something that's not offerable. That's our standard. So it's not that chilies are wrong. But, you know, where's the line where it's too much? I've seen where it's too much. And where's our standard? Look at Jhumpa's cookbook. That's one simple answer. Or Korma's cookbook, both, because they were trained. But Jhumpa particularly was, you know, she for nearly half a year just directly trained by Prabhupada.
Yeah, I remember following the Muna's cookbook and they're using chilies.
Yeah.
And she has this thing that she takes the seeds out of the chilies when she uses the chilies. And then he gets a kick, but he doesn't get that extreme heat.
And I'm sure the numbers are also. But there's, you know, there's some parts of the world, not only parts of India, but parts of the world where it's tons of chilies. Isn't there like a Mexican food chain that's their logo is a chili?
Now, can that then pass as, I mean, it passes to some temples as offerable, or at least, you know, is that an example?
That's an example. There's something that's prior to training gets imported without any training, without any screening or correction. Anything else? Yes.
You were mentioning about someone took the pictures and the radiative worship minister took the pictures and showed it to DDC so that the standards are not maintained or across and all that. And even in the organization of many events, sometimes the people who are involved in planning things, they may not be like if there are people who are not second initiated or Brahminically trained or trained about the deity worship standards are not involved in planning of events, a lot of things fall through the crack. And so the persons who are involved in the event planning, they may not be even aware that there are standards set in ISKCON, which are based on higher instructions. And so a lot of times, you know, you may see things happen in the last minute, you have to fix things. And, how do we prevent those things? Because it's not like somebody wants to do something wrong, but it could be like because there isn't any qualified person in there to guide, or maybe people are not even aware that things should be attended to in a certain way. And so that kind of thing, those kind of things contribute to the overall standards going down. And before
particularly with activities that are directly under the umbrella of deity worship, then it's the importance is elevated of recognizing standards, maintaining standards, upholding standards, and not compromising. And one part of the answer is we can prioritize where concern should go. That's one part. Another part is just training. Like I had little experience when I was the temple Sankirtan leader, and we had arrangements where on Saturdays everybody in the temple except two people went on Sankirtan for the whole day, Saturday, book distribution. And as many congregation people as could go also went. It was every Saturday. It was just like, it was very ecstatic. So one time, there wasn't enough lunches made. And so I scurried, I was the temple Sankirtan leader, so I scurried into the kitchen and made a little makeshift altar and in a hurried way made an offering. And it, you know, wasn't, the consciousness wasn't right. So one older devotee saw me doing that. They didn't say anything, but they reported to the temple president, who later, you know, asked me, did this happen, and described the circumstances and said, you know, this isn't right. And, you know, in my heart I knew he was right, it wasn't right, and so here's what you should, this is the standard you should maintain. Is that okay? Yeah, sure, that's okay, I understand. So there were future circumstances where we didn't have enough lunches, and so a proper offering was, in the proper manner, was made. But training. So that at least, you know, the sincere devotees can understand this is standard. It's not, it was done in this particular case. I've seen cases where it's not done nicely. You know, the correction is, you know, harsh and bullying and all that stuff. But this wasn't the case. It was done very nicely. So that we can maintain by training. And a third comment is, when we're doing expansive outreach, then something like this can happen. What Prabhupada indicated for restaurants, where temples had restaurants, they could make a morning offering that would be the menu for the day. And then the preparations that came after that were also considered offered, because the idea at the beginning of the day is they would be prasadam, although it was still in the cut, not yet cooked, you know, form. So it's a different standard in one sense, because it's not literally being placed on the plate before the deity, although later on it would be, it was considered offered. So that's another area where standards would sometimes go down. Then it just requires, you know, it doesn't require the mode of passion, it requires the mode of goodness, a mode of goodness person to be mindful of what standards are. And just as we did, we invited the deity worship minister to come and, how are we doing? His business was not to crack the whip and, you know, order people around and, you know, chastise people. His service was a brahminical one. Audit, have dialogue, get a clear understanding of what the, you know, the obstacles were, and manpower or money or whatever the, or facility or something, and then make recommendations. So inviting the mode of goodness into a situation can help maintain standards.
So in this con, with that intention, then the worship minister does the internal audits of that nature. Do we have some kind of like an action item?
Yes. Oh yeah. In fact, there was the temple president and Head Pujari got a report, and the GBC got a more detailed report. And then the GBCs are discussing implementation. Because we're not, you know, we invited the audit, we should, you know, follow up the implementation. But it really takes a lot of commitment. And without commitment, things don't happen. So there's commitment to expand, and then your point was, you know, we have programs, people that mean well may not understand standards, so we need training.
Yes, especially like we have, what we are talking about, the temple, and then again there is this further distance away from the temple program.
Yeah, programs. So it requires training. And the standards of what's offered, the first point was there's prioritizing of standards, and if it's something that's offered to Panchatattva, it's not like, oh, we don't care about them. Mm-hmm. But the standards are less stringent, and the reactions are less stringent. And the mood is more giving, freely giving mercy. So an unbrahminically initiated person, an unrefined, untrained, unqualified person can be engaged in outreach where it's not involved with Radha Krishna installed deities. And that way they can practice, awaken more deeply the mood of giving of mercy, and in a gradual way get trained in standards. Now, your point is, you do like that, and it, does that not have a tendency? It seems that it has a tendency to reduce the understanding of what standards are. Well, we did that in this event, you know, why? How come you're all, you know, fuss-punchety about standards over here? That's immaturity. With maturity, I don't, by making this comment, I want to avoid inviting, you know, bashing people because they're not up to standard, because that doesn't bring people to standard. That drives people away. Brahminical influence establishes standards and maintains standards. We need to invite training and education and brahminical quality with proper devotion. Yes.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, so you are saying that we have to, while we are, one of our missions is to spread the mission of Lord Chaitanya.
Sure is.
At the same time, and so that means bringing new people into the folds of the movement.
Yes.
And so they are enthusiastic to serve.
Without knowing standards.
Yeah, and so without, you know, sort of dousing their enthusiasm, encouraging them, but then so creating really a culture where they ask, oh, I want to do this, but how, you know, where did I begin? So how do we create that culture?
Mm-hmm. Well, part of it is selecting the right people. And, you know, giving, like she said, organizers of events, that was her. But let people know that we have standards. I mean, like for some people, just the fact that we have standards rubs people the wrong way. But, you know, when people get a little closer, they understand, hey, these people have standards. So, if we're dealing with newcomers in a respectful, courteous manner, and they're willing to grow in their Krishna consciousness, then that's how you create the culture. Then they'll naturally want to ask, or if they haven't asked, when you say, okay, before we take this undertaking, let's go over what some of our standards are. Because they understand this is an organization that has standards, and there's a reason why they have standards. They want purity. They want to offer to Krishna with purity. So I'm not there yet, so I gotta open up my receivers here and see what those standards are, so we can offer purity.
So it's a mixture of sometimes waiting, inviting them to ask, and sometimes sharing it ahead.
Sure. It's like called the relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes we're the subject and sometimes we're the object. Sometimes we're giving, sometimes we're receiving. One student at Washington University asked a question very similar. His question was, you know, I want to bring social change. I really like what this presentation you made, but how do you do it? Because one of the things I don't like is when people come on with, you know, I got the answer, get on board. And right away I go, well, you know, where you come from? You haven't even had a conversation to know what I want. You're giving me the answer. So, you know, how do we not do that? How do you invite change, social, his thing was social change. So the answer I gave was two things. Service without motivation. And purity, personal purity. Put the combination of those two things together and elaborate it. He didn't expect that answer. He was very satisfied. I spent 10 minutes going over the details of that, but that's the culture. When we're inviting people, we're not hammering people. We're serving them. Genuinely serving them. Is that Gulshan's hand up in the air?
Maharaj, I have a question about personal struggle and confusion. Like
personal which kind of confusion?
Confusion and struggle I have.
Okay.
When we are having like big festivals like Festival of the Holy Name or things like that, when it's 3-day events or 4-day big events, when we are cooking in the kitchen, like I understand that you don't eat before offering the deity to the deity, or whole day when several meals have to be cooked, I try to follow the standard of
good.
Being clean.
Good.
But then due to health reasons, sometimes it becomes difficult for me to stay hungry and without water until the evening. So what to do then, Mara?
You know the answer. Huh?
Because I feel so guilty if I do it, like if I drink water.
You shouldn't feel guilty if you drink water. That's silly. If you didn't drink water, you become dehydrated and become sick, and that would be very bad. So drink water. Drink water in such a way that you don't become moochy. You know. You can do that? And not spill it all over yourself? Do that. Little bottle with a little spout and just... You can do that. Okay?
I have another.
Okay.
Also, like, sometimes, you know, the meal gets delayed to serve, for the spiritual master to eat. And then, what to do in that case?
What can you do? You mean the spiritual master is late or the cooking is late? Huh?
The spiritual master is late.
Then they're just... Ask the other people that know what to do when that happens. I don't know. I mean, you put it in a place where it doesn't spoil. You warm it when it's time for serving.
But my question is about being
you do what's practical. Do what's practical. The answer that I gave you before should help you understand. And it's that the following the letter is not the essence. The essence is the devotion. And, you know, if circumstances are radical, then you do what's needed. Okay? Yes.
You're mentioning that practicing devotee should be very, very careful to stay in an example setting mode of being. Did I understand that right?
Yeah, we should try for that, sure.
The thing I'm not very sure of is I just go on that particular, I want to set an example for others rather than trying to actually be that person that I'm supposed to be.
Practice is a beginning. Supposing we're not being that, but we can practice. This way I responded to Gulshan's question is the behavior is not the essence. The essence is the essence. But the behavior connect the wish to be that with the behavior. The practice can help you awaken that sense of quality. Okay? I think we're done. Srila Prabhupada. What's that?